Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The writer and linguist Amanda Montell says in her new book that in moments of fierce uncertainty, even reasonable brains start to buckle. But when this happens, she says, we have evolved these shortcuts or cheats to help us cope, like magical thinking. It's the belief that our internal thoughts can influence and change external events.
The first time I think I ever came across the phrase magical thinking was in Joan Didion's memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. I didn't really understand what that phrase meant. I knew it was really beautiful. I thought maybe it had to do with like fairy tales or something like that, or imagination. And then, of course, I read the memoir and I really related to this habit of infusing your life with fictional tales and mythologies as an attempt to make sense of tragedies or confounding turns of events. And in the case of Joan Didion, whose voice is so grounded and so sort of spare, something that you really trust as logical, she was so compelling in her story of grieving the untimely sudden death of her husband through all of this magical thinking, where she thought, for example, she couldn't get rid of the shoes, his shoes, in their closet because she was afraid if she did, then he really, really, really might not come back. It's a type of superstitious behavior that otherwise reasonable brains really start to engage in during times of tragedy when we're just like overwhelmed with a lack of agency. And I really saw this type of behavior dialed up to an 11 in the modern culture, the information age. We are just tasked with an unmanageable onslaught of information, true and false, every single day. And that itself creates its own kind of chaos and panic and grief, even if the tragedy that's happening is unrelated to your life or is transpiring 6,000 miles away. It can feel really threatening. Even, you know, a bout of social media conflict in the comment section on Instagram can feel like a threat, can feel really destabilizing. And I was noticing that in response to so many modern phenomena, from extreme celebrity worship to, you know, Instagram manifestation gurus, people were really engaging in a lot of magical thinking. But I've termed it magical overthinking, which I've described as the product of this clash between our natural human mysticisms and imperfect decision-making strategies and the modern information age. The human mind really developed for a set of problems that were much more physical and grounded than so many of the ones that we're tasked to confront every single day now. Often our problems now are not oriented toward survival, toward, you know, avoiding predators and things like that. They're a little more abstract and cerebral and disembodied, but our minds haven't really caught up to that yet. And so the way that I wanted to depict magical overthinking was by taking basically my 11 favorite cognitive biases, and I used each one as a lens to explore some example of magical overthinking, some mysterious irrationality plaguing the broader zeitgeist and my own life. There are so many curious irrationalities in our culture at the moment, and I really found that cognitive biases could explain so much of the illogic I was seeing in the culture at large, including and especially my own.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Amanda Montell's book is The Age of Magical Overthinking. She's our guest for the hour. And she told us she wrote the book as a yearning. That's where we began.
I think I will spend my whole life yearning to understand my own mind and my own behavior and the behaviors of others and hopefully feel better. But the problem is that, you know, more information doesn't actually always help something make more sense, and it doesn't always help something feel better.
Right.
And yet I don't want to give up on that pursuit. So I sort of wrote this book aiming to understand behavior in the contemporary culture that I could have once written off as evil or nonsensical. I wanted to comprehend it and appreciate it and forgive it. And in the end, what writing about all these cognitive biases did was help me drum up a little more compassion toward other people's irrationalities and skepticism of my own. But I think that I will always be on that sort of swing, that pendulum between, you know, like really giving up and feeling quite fatalistic about where our culture is going and then feeling hopeful and compassionate. And, you know, this book is so much about juxtapositions between logos and pathos, you know, head and heart, truth and beauty. And, you know, there's a lot of yearning wrapped up in that swing.
It makes me wonder, as you're writing something like this and you're working through all of these things and you come to your own kind of insights as you're talking to all these, you know, different researchers and reading about these studies and all these kinds of things, like what you think can come from something like this as you share all of this. And I wanted to read something that you write early on. You say that you want us, you know, us readers, to become as aware as we can of our mind's natural distortions, to see the beauty and the folly in this way of thinking, you say, ought to be part of our era's shared mission. Now, I'm not saying you're thinking, oh, I've now created the shared mission for everybody, but it does say something about what you're aspiring to here. You want us to be thinking more deeply about these questions you're getting at. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, you know, as our contemporary problems only continue to become more abstract, you know, there's such incredible fear and panic and hope surrounding AI, and technology changes exponentially every single day. I think it's going to increasingly become our task to become aware of our mind's natural limits, because otherwise, you know, conflicts will only continue to increase, these sort of ideological conflicts. And I was inspired to make that sort of lofty and optimistic statement based on a statement that the Marxist philosopher Franz Fanon wrote in 1961. He said, "Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it." And I thought, you know, if I may be so bold, our mission, it seems, kind of has to do with the mind.
Well, I want to begin with the recency illusion for no particular reason, other than, like, it seemed interesting to start with aliens and UFOs. So this section of the book, this part of the book, begins with this 60 Minutes piece. You and your partner Casey watch a lot of space videos, you say. So talk about this part, how we get into this. Tell this story.
Yeah, sure. Well, the recency illusion describes our tendency to think that something is new and thus urgent and worthy of panic just because it's new to us. And this stems from an adaptive purpose. It's deep within us, this evolutionary bias. It stems from the notion that recency is linked to relevance. And so you can imagine a time in human history where a person might notice a rustling in the bushes, and it didn't matter to them whether that rustling in the bushes indicated an animal that had been there for 5 seconds or 5 minutes, the fact that they were hearing that rustling now meant that it was more urgent now, and they should probably respond to it because it might be a predator that was close and on the move and could pose a threat to them. And even if that rustling in the bushes ended up being a little mouse and not a big predator, it was worth it to overreact and to run. And we are now applying these sort of fight, flight, and freeze responses to objectively non-urgent problems, like a clickbait headline or a curt email from a boss. But I wanted to find my way into this exploration of how the recency illusion is clashing with the digital age through that story of the UAP,
right.
This rebranding of UFOs that first emerged in 2021, that summer, when I found out about it through this 60 Minutes broadcast, where a number of military officers were being interviewed by the sort of very serious telejournalist about their UAP sightings. And the government was finally declassifying documents that had been around since the 80s. And I just recall there being this incredible panic about UAP and the aliens that had, you know, apparently come to visit, or if they weren't aliens, who knows what it was. But, right. You know, many people jumped to the conclusion that it was aliens because that's more fun and more imaginative, I think. I just remember thinking it was rather curious that these documents and these sightings had happened a long time ago. But because the news was emerging now, we all acted like this was this brand new threat that was worthy of our panic and attention. We acted as if the aliens had just gotten here,
even though
some of those reports were 30 years old.
Right.
And so that was the sort of like perfect representation of the recency illusion. And of course, it's fun because I sort of started that chapter in the tone of like a dramatic sci-fi novel or something like that. Because indeed, I do love to watch YouTube videos and documentaries about space, because when in doubt and when all the overthinking gets to be too much, it's good to take some solace in the stars.
Yeah. Well, you said that watching that 60 Minutes piece with Casey felt like a riddle. And that you described being kind of desperate to understand what made the reports feel so threatening. Say a little bit more about that. Like, you really – and I wonder, is this an inclination of yours to when you're feeling something or noticing something, that you want to make sense of it and you think, I could write about this, or I could say something about this?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly with this book, it was such a sort of gift to be able to use my anxieties and my penchant for overthinking as an opportunity to be curious about them and to write about them and to speak to behavioral economists and psychologists about what's really going on, because I am absolutely not immune to reacting to a clickbait headline or a news piece about UAP or even something silly like this new cellulite cure will blah blah blah.
Right.
You know, I am totally susceptible to responding to those things with urgency and panic. And of course, the panic increases when the stakes of the story are higher. And I just had to ask, you know, like, what about the human mind convinces us that a piece of new information is worthy of panic? And then, sort of just as mysteriously, what makes us so swiftly forget once that panic response leaves our body and move on, even though that potential threat was so urgent to us yesterday, whether it's a news piece about aliens or famine or what have you. And then I had to wonder, like, folks with media power, do they know this neuroscience? Like, are they exploiting our nervous systems on purpose, or does something have a hold on them too? And that was an opportunity to talk to behavioral economists about this recency illusion. And, you know, as it turns out, and this is the answer to so many of the questions that I had, it's kind of both and, you know, like we have this very, very strong impulse that served us really well for thousands upon thousands of years to, you know, trust our attention as the most reliable barometer for how to react to things for survival purposes. But in so many ways, the survival concerns that we had for most of human history are kind of taken care of. And so we can no longer trust our attention as the most reliable barometer when evaluating the stakes and potential threats of so much of the news stories that we hear every single day.
Well, this part of the book becomes this kind of meditation on how humans perceive time. And what's great about it is you kind of propose this strategy. And the book isn't necessarily where you say, here's the problem, here's my solution. But there is a strategy you mentioned that is worth thinking about anyway for, you know, at least regaining some control over our perception of time. And it has to do with awe.
Yes.
Tell us about awe, because this part I loved.
Well, I was particularly in this chapter desperate to come upon some smidge of relief for how we can get out of these spirals of attention and urgency and panic. And I came across a bunch of fascinating research about awe. Dacher Keltner is a UC Berkeley psychology professor who wrote a book called Awe. And I learned from some of his research that awe is... Well, it's this, a lot of us know what it is, but to define it in more academic terms, it is this sort of humbling wonder that we encounter when we are in the midst of mysteries that we don't quite understand. So immersion in nature or live music or collective dance, spiritual rituals, psychedelics. And awe has this amazing benefit of making time feel more slow. So there's research to suggest that walks in nature make time feel more expansive, even than walks in cities. I came across research suggesting that a feeling of awe makes people feel less materialistic and more oriented toward experiences rather than objects or material things. But the time piece was the most interesting part of it to me because, you know, when I am in my own thought spirals of overthinking and panic, I find that it's really important to step aside of myself. I love that the slang phrase touch grass has become so popular. And I think it's really actually rooted in this notion of awe because we need to get outside of ourselves. We need to experience that humbling wonder. And it connects to space as well. You know, when I feel like I'm not able to gain proper perspective on my problems or to interrupt one of those thought spirals, just, you know, reminding myself of my puniness. it doesn't make me panic, even though you'd think, you know, the universe is really big and that could be anxiety provoking. But instead, I find that feeling of awe is so powerful and it interrupts the thought spiral just enough that I'm able to a little bit better analyze, you know, what is worthy of my panic, what is meaningful versus urgent, what needs to be addressed right now versus later versus not at all.
Well, one final story opportunity here is you mentioned the summer of 2021, waking up, I think you said, nearly every morning with this nauseating sense of anxiety. And then you went to the mountains. And it sure helped, right?
It really did, at least for a spell, you know. In particular, I went to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Western North Carolina. I found that just spending a few days amid those, you know, incredibly humbling mountains sort of gave me the gift of that reclamation of time. There's this great quote that I included in the book by the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He said, "Perhaps wilderness is an antidote to our post-industrial self-absorption."
Amanda Montell, her book is The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Thank you.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Amanda Montell is with us. And in her new book, she explains how over time, a very long time, our brains came up with these shortcuts that allowed us to make sense of the environment so we could survive it. These clever cheats are called cognitive biases. And Montell says they were always irrational, but they did the job for a very long time. But now our machines are malfunctioning, and these shortcuts are making us overthink and underthink the wrong things. Her book is called The Age of Magical Overthinking. What's the halo effect?
The halo effect is, I always feel like I'm doing a pop quiz. I can do it. No, the halo effect is our tendency to admire one quality in a person and then jump to the conclusion that they must be perfect overall. And this stems from the ways that we used to find role models and still do. So the halo effect was really useful during a time in human history when we lived in small communities. You would notice someone in your tribe who had, you know, big muscles and intact teeth. And you would jump to the conclusion that, oh, they must be, you know, a skilled hunter. And that's why they've eaten so much meat and gotten big muscles. Or they must be a really strong fighter and have avoided disfigurement from battle. This would be a good person for me to align myself with for survival purposes. These, you know, conclusions that you might jump to were imperfect, but they were good enough. And the halo effect is showing up in really fascinating ways in the modern age because we are now mapping that conclusion jumping onto modern parasocial relationships with celebrities.
Yeah.
So we enjoy a pop star's music. We jump to the conclusion that they must be educated, worldly, nurturing, perhaps that they care about us as much as we care about them. Perhaps they align politically with our values. And these expectations parasocially are elevating celebrities onto this, you know, sky-high pedestal that they simply can't live up to. And when they invariably disappoint fans, they end up really falling from that pedestal in a pretty dramatic way. And so I was interested to note that the halo effect is partially responsible for these, you know, extreme cycles of celebrity worship and dethronement that we're seeing.
Well, I think the part that interested me, I mean, outside of, you know, fans turning on Taylor Swift, I think the thing that interested me about this section was that you say that the first subjects of this halo effect were parental figures. And this brings us to your mom, Dr. Denise Montell. And with her, you say the halo effect was inescapable. Talk a little bit about, first of all, say something about your mom. She sounds incredible.
Yeah. Well, I make a sort of cheeky joke in the book that I was the unhinged Swiftie to my mother,
right.
Taylor Swift. Yeah, there's a lot to live up to with my mom. She's a cancer cell biologist. She, you know, has dedicated her life to curing cancer. She's brilliant. She's won awards, you know. I've been extremely impressed with her. And she also, you know, she just has like amazing taste in everything and like, you know, knows how to blow out her hair really
right.
well. And, you know, she's like an amazing cook and she was like a really good mom. I'm not complaining at all. This is all to say that, you know, that said, I because there were these qualities that she had that were, you know, really impressive. And because she worked a lot and she was doing all of these impressive things, I sort of built her up in my mind as perfect. She was not human to me. She was this sort of, yeah, this larger than life superhuman figure. And, you know, that caused a bit of conflict because when she would behave in a way that was human, I sort of felt the need as an adolescent to punish her in some ways. You know, I was like sort of horrified that she was just a human being.
Right.
And we were able to work through those issues with, you know, empathy and communication and all the tools that you have in actual like one-on-one in-person relationships. But I really noticed some familiarity and relatability in some of the ways that you know, fans of not just Taylor Swift, but so many celebrities now would treat the subject of their fanaticism. It was almost like a surrogate parent-child relationship, but it was parasocial. And, you know, the celebrity could never live up to their expectations. And they also could never work through those conflicts because the relationship was one-sided. And so I actually came across some really fascinating research suggesting an actual correlation between celebrity worship and parenting. There were studies that suggested that, you know, those who are sort of lacking so-called positive stressors from their real-life parental figures and their real-life communities were more inclined towards celebrity stalking. Celebrity worship has grown more intense over the past few decades, and that has come with some deleterious mental health consequences. Yeah, it was really interesting to note that when the halo effect applies to people that we know in real life, like our parents and teachers, a study that I found suggested that that actually predicted, you know, higher educational achievement and self-esteem, even when it was like unreasonable worship of those IRL role models. But when applied to celebrities, it predicted the opposite, sort of lower self-esteem and lower educational achievement. And yet I understand why people are sort of reaching toward celebrities as a role model figure, because we are lacking trust in other, you know, forms of role models like the government and the healthcare system and traditional religion. We need somewhere to put that. And for whatever reason, if we're unable to put that toward role models in real life because of the isolation due to the pandemic or another reason, we put it towards celebrities, but that's a relationship that can never really be mended in the same way.
Let's come back to your mom here finally in this part, because you write about this time when you were in high school and you had this really nasty fight with your mother. And she does this really, I have to say, a great thing. She starts to email you these really long letters. And I wanted you to talk about this part because you say the letters were, this is how you put it, crucially humanizing. And so they didn't extinguish this halo, but you say they lit up the world around her, the environment around her, so you could appreciate the context. Say more about what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, when you imagine a halo, you can picture a sort of, you know, Renaissance painting where a crown of light illuminates an angel. What that also does is darken the background because there's this spotlight on the figure in the foreground. And when you darken the background, all the context, like, you can't perceive their full humanity. And so, yeah, I had this experience where my mom and I got into it. I was sort of chastising her for not being human enough. And instead of sort of dismissing that, she addressed it in a way that felt most comfortable to her. She sort of turned me into a pen pal and started emailing me these stories from her romantic life. Yeah. And it was so mind-blowing to me as an adolescent to think about the person that my mom was before I was alive. And it really helped me see her more holistically. And I think being able to perceive people not as either, you know, perfect angels or disgraced demons, even if those people are celebrities, is so important as an empathy exercise. The issue is that you're probably not going to be able to exchange, you know, 5,000 word emails with Taylor Swift. Yeah. So that's gonna have to be like a slightly more personal journey. I don't know if you've ever been through a parasocial breakup where you decide to disengage from a public figure with whom you once shared a parasocial relationship. But it can feel really disorienting and silly. And so, you know, those are just, that's a new kind of dynamic that we're having to navigate.
There's a part of the book where you explore this cognitive bias called declinism. I wanted to talk about that. I guess it's this idea that things now are are worse, or way worse than they used to be. Talk a little bit about this. Do you see a lot of this? I mean, when you mentioned how you notice it a lot in language, and certainly in a presidential election year, I'm sure you see a lot of this sort of declinism in politics too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, a lot of these cognitive biases have sort of an affective analog, an emotional analog. And so zero-sum bias is to envy, the way that declinism is to nostalgia. So just like you said, declinism is this tendency to think that, you know, life is just getting irreversibly worse and worse and worse. It's all downhill from here. And this also relates to time, because the human mind is so odd about time. We tend to sort of catastrophize the present.
Yeah.
Dismiss the future and romanticize the past, because the past is all that we have, you know, like the past is, those are our memories, but also memory is a form of imagination. And so when the present feels painful, the future doesn't feel like a good resource for feeling better, because the future is unpredictable and unpredictability is scary. But the past feels like a well of idealization. You know, we have relics from the past, photo albums and, you know, old doilies and, you know, things that we can really romanticize. And that can be a really healthy thing. You know, I wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about creating nostalgia for the present. And I spoke to a nostalgia scholar named Clay Routledge for that. And he assured me that nostalgia is really a healthy coping mechanism, particularly this form of nostalgia called personal nostalgia, where we romanticize our own personal memories, things that we really lived through. Okay, maybe high school wasn't all that great, but if we need something to cling to in order to envision a better future, then, you know, developing a fantasy about the past is not so bad. It's really when public figures, from tradwife influencers to presidential candidates, weaponize nostalgia by saying, you know, America was once, you know, there was once a golden age, and this happens across the world, not just in America, but, you know, there was once a golden age in the United States, and we can return to that. That golden age most certainly did not exist, but they assure people who are already motivated by declinism that that really is true. And guess what? I, and only I, can restore the nation to its former glory. And they might catastrophize all kinds of present concerns, make them seem like they are way worse than anything ever was in the past, even though that's objectively not true, as a way to sell their flock on a vision of the future. And this, you know, will probably ring very familiar to listeners, how this habit can show up in politics. But I think it is so critical to be aware of this declinism quality, because, you know, we can't allow ourselves to sort of succumb to fatalism.
Yeah. You know, I was really interested in so there's the part where we glorify the past under this declinism. We over-dramatize the present. But it's the future part that I wanted to ask you about. How does this catastrophizing, you know, the past, or the present, how does that affect the way we look at the future? There's this – you mentioned this study from UCLA from – I think it was 2015 that found people – conceive of their future selves as strangers. You see, we find it hard to care about those random nobodies, even though there are soon to be selves. And I wondered, so that's how we're thinking about the future. Like, and what does that mean then for the way we conceive of the future and the way we, you know, you mentioned the climate crisis. Like, that is one thing that seems catastrophic, right? That we should really be worried about. But how do you plan for that? How do you sort of simmer down and make a rational plan when your ideas about the future are so weird?
Right. Well, this connects to that idea of our shared mission being about the mind, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, our declinism is so powerful, but we really now, in an urgent and material way, have to figure out how to push past it. And maybe we never had to do that before, but now we really, really do. Because yes, like that 2015 UCLA study that you mentioned, it found that, you know, one of the reasons why we might like procrastinate or not save money or not eat very well or, you know, yeah, not do what's right for the environment, which is in many ways not a personal problem. There's a lot of, well, I can't solve the climate crisis, but, you know, the reason why we sometimes engage in behaviors that aren't great for our future selves is because we truly conceive of those future people as like these random nobodies that, yeah, I would not want to help. I mean, in a very low stakes way, I find declinism, or I find this sort of present bias is really how you can describe this phenomenon. I find it showing up in the situation where, like, let's say my parents invite me to, you know, some kind of boring sounding event, but like 6 months from now. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, sure, 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 I'll go to that. And then 6 months from now, it rolls around. And I'm like, why did my past self do this to me? It's because I didn't care. I didn't care what happened to her. And so that is so, so powerful and shows up in so many contexts, both low stakes and high stakes. But I do think that the awareness of this present bias and this declinism is at least the first step in acknowledging that, again, like our most base intuitions about how we should spend our time and how we should point our attention, wow, aren't really enough anymore.
Well, you also mentioned how the idea of talking about the coming catastrophe, the moment we're in is being catastrophic and there's no hope, is not really helpful to the, you know, to solving the problem. And you say there might be this shift going on from catastrophe to what there's this climate activist, Leah Thomas, you talked to, she called radical imagination, that maybe there's a shift away from that. Can you say a little bit about what she's seeing?
Yeah. Yeah. I spoke to her about a year and a half ago. She's a climate activist. And she was telling me how, you know, there was a time earlier in her career where she could very, very easily identify what she was fighting against, what systems she was fighting against. But if someone were to ask her what she was fighting for, that was difficult to answer. And she didn't feel good about that. So Leah was kind of explaining to me how there's been a shift in the environmental movement, at least her corner of it, toward, yeah, this idea of radical imagination. Like, what if things could go as well as they could? Mm. You know, what if things went ideally, and what would that look like? And let's act as if that's possible. Because the news is more engaging when it's negative. The news is more engaging when it, obviously, when it feels novel, and not negative information often feels more novel. If someone tweets something negative, even if it isn't true, they'll seem like they're in the know. Uh-huh. And we're more inclined to pay attention to that, again, because it's a threat. And so what's unfortunate is that climate activists are now having to sort of compete in the economy of doom slang to get across their sort of measured action items or their radical imagination. And, you know, it's almost like sort of edgy now, or I guess, yeah, it's uncool to have hope sometimes on the internet.
Yeah.
Those aren't the memes that people want to retweet, at least not in my sort of spaces, my left-wing spaces. It's much cooler and also feels more civically responsible to acknowledge what's going wrong. But the climate activists and psychologists and other experts that I spoke to this book, that I spoke to for this book, had a sort of different point of view, because I posed a question to many of them, which was just simply like, if there were any other time in history that you could live in, what would it be? And not a single person wanted to go back in time.
Right.
They were all like, I would rather live right now. You know, like, the climate crisis is terrible. There are a lot of awful things happening in the world. But most things are not worse than they once were.
Yeah.
And also, we can't actually go back. The future is where we're going. And, you know, I identify as an optimist. And I know that not everybody does and not everybody can. But becoming aware of our declinism can hopefully put some things into perspective.
I love the James Baldwin quote you include. I can't be a pessimist because I am alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And he has another part of that quote that's like, if I'm not to be an optimist, then I have to treat life as an academic matter.
Right.
And I so love that sentiment. I saw Maggie Nelson on book tour last year, and she quoted that James Baldwin quote too. And Maggie Nelson is like such a serious and impressive writer, but she was like, I'm an optimist, so sue me. And it was just like really cool to see that this writer that I find brilliant and so respect, even she is an optimist. That has to say something.
Amanda Montell, her latest book is The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and linguist Amanda Montell is with us today. And in her new book, she says our brains are having a hard time keeping up with the information age. She says the internet culture has short-circuited our ancient coping mechanisms. So our sense of irrationality and competition has just gone off the charts. The book is called The Age of Magical Overthinking. I want to end with the IKEA effect. You once had a therapist who recommended you should get a hobby, and you kind of – this is how you put it in the book. Like you winced at the idea, like, I don't know about that. And after some fits and starts, you became a furniture flipper. Just before we talk about the sort of effect itself, say something about the pleasure that came from doing this. How do you explain that? How do you talk about that?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, this is an unflattering fact about me, but I'm not good with my hands. I can't craft. I can't cook. Not a domestic goddess. And so, you know, hobbies always felt a little threatening to me. But then, there's a lid for every pot. And indeed, in the pandemic, I discovered the transformative art of furniture flipping, where, you know, you acquire sort of dilapidated, forgotten about homewares, chairs, mirrors, whatever. You might find them at Goodwill or, you know, on Facebook Marketplace or in the back of your own closet. And you just sort of gussy them up, you know, slap a new coat of paint on them, super glue the cane chair back together, whatever you got to do.
Right.
Stage them beautifully on Facebook Marketplace and, turn a profit. I cannot say we made any money. I did this with my best friend, and we spent so much on – we are not good capitalists. We did not turn a profit on our furniture flipping endeavor. But it didn't matter because we were so self-satisfied. And this is how it connects to the IKEA effect. There were a couple of instances where we would acquire a piece that was just – hideously ugly.
Yeah.
And we'd be like, oh, I don't know if there's a lot of hope for this piece. You know, we'll dust it off, see what we can do. But then by the time that we had finished applying that coat of paint or our super glue job or whatever it was, we were like, oh my God, this thing is stunningly beautiful. It could go for thousands on a certain website, you know, like let's price it higher than we were intending to.
Yeah.
And this was confounding to me. I was like, wait, no. 30 minutes ago, I thought this was the ugliest seashell lamp I've ever seen. Now, after my shoddy pink paint job, I think it's a work of art. And as it turns out, this connects to a real cognitive bias called the IKEA effect, which is our tendency to think that something is more valuable because we participated in its creation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of us can probably connect to that self-satisfied feeling where when you help make something with your own hands, even if it turns out crappy, studies show that we value things that we help create as like equally valuable to professionally made things, which is so irrational, but also kind of quaint and charming. And it bridged into all these questions about, you know, co-created brands and how does AI factor into all of this, AI generated art and things like that. So
this may be my favorite cognitive bias in the book, the IKEA effect, because It has something to do with us wanting the thing that we make or do to matter, that we want it to have some kind of significance. So that's the good part. Like, I think that's great. But then you mention in the book that you could argue the IKEA effect is the driving force behind the popularity of TikTok. And there's where it doesn't seem so good.
Yeah, well, TikTok very cleverly exploited the IKEA effect, probably not on purpose, but, you know, with the stitch feature and the fact that TikTok is so collaborative, you know, everybody can feel like they're a part of making something. And that can be a beautiful thing. I mean, I am not currently on TikTok, but I was using it a little bit during the first phase of COVID lockdown. And I remember watching videos where, like, really talented musicians from across the world would stitch and duet each other's videos to create these, like, amazing pieces of music that would not have been possible before TikTok. But there are, of course, downsides as well. Like, technological progress is always a double-edged sword, as are these cognitive biases themselves. And so, you know, there's a lot of delusion. I mean, I think of crowdfunding platforms like GoFundMe and Indiegogo, where, like, aspiring video game creators will raise millions of dollars to, you know, only create something that's terrible and non-functional and lose all those millions of dollars of crowdfunded investor money. And that can be exploitative. But again, it comes from this very, this very, very quaint place where, you know, we want to put our hands on things. We want to say, you know, we were a part of this and we mattered and we collaborated. Like, humans are so, so communal, and find it so much more satisfying when we can not only create something with our hands, but show it to our friends. That was something that this sort of, like, critical IKEA effect study that I found and served as the basis for this chapter uncovered, is that, like, study participants not only valued the little, like, boxes and origami figures that they were creating as, you know, more equally valuable to professionally made ones, but they, like, actively wanted to show them to their friends. So, you know, like, crafting and DIY and making things, it just offers the opportunity for connection. And that's why, you know, loneliness has been described as an epidemic, and loneliness is so corrosive to the human spirit. We want to do things that allow us to connect.
Final question, and I want to bring in the, as you do in the book, the poet Sylvia Plath, because you get at this question in the book: will we, as you say, always feel like we're on the outmost brink of losing touch with our primal selves? But you say in the book that we've always felt like this. Like, this is always a sentiment that we have, that the modern world has, you know, is stripping away from us what it means to be human. How did the poet Sylvia Plath respond to that? Because I really like this part.
Oh, yeah. Well, I found this prose piece that she wrote in the early 60s, where she was criticizing poets' habit during that time, in, like, 1962, of invoking the era's major political conflicts, like the Cold War, and talking about them as if, like, that period of time was sure to go down in history as the worst period of time. And she had this quote where she said, "For me, the real issues of our time are the issues of every time. The hurt and wonder of loving, making in all its forms, children, loaves of bread, paintings, buildings, and the conservation of life of all people in all places, the jeopardizing of which no abstract double talk of peace or implacable foes can excuse." And, I mean, that feels like such a timeless sentiment. Sylvia Plath is a kind of, like, ghost character in this book, the way that Didion is. And I just really took a lot of solace in that sentiment because, like, I don't know, I started writing this book after the world really started opening up after the pandemic, when people were, you know, really making loaves of bread and painting and, you know, we there's just, like, such a symmetry and circularity of life. And maybe this is my nostalgia kicking in, but, you know, I took some comfort in knowing that, you know, in 1962, There were people feeling the exact same way as we're feeling now, and maybe there is hope after all.
Amanda Montell, thank you very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Amanda Montell, her book is The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us with comments or questions at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.